Welcome to American Patchwork and Quilting Radio, your one stop for creative inspiration. We have a terrific hour of ideas and tips for you today, so let's get to it. Here's your host, Pat Sloan.
Hello, everybody. This is Pat Sloan, and I am so excited about the show today. We're going to do some deep dive technique talk with a couple of my guests. So that's always fun when we get to have a chance to go into things in a little bit more detail. First, I have Nancy Kern back on the show. And Nancy is a great appliqueur, a great teacher, and she's been out and about doing things all over the place. And when she was here in December, we talked about having her come back on and chat with me more about taking workshops, because a lot of you love to do that. So hi, Nancy, how are you?
I'm great, Pat. Thanks.
You know what, Nancy, when we were talking before, we sort of touched on taking workshops, and quilters love to learn, don't they?
I think so.
Yeah, they're always out there looking for the next thing that can, you know, just have fun with. And, you know, I thought it would be great if we talked a little bit about how you best take a workshop or take a class and what kind of things are really out there, because you've taught at a lot of different formats and places. When did you take your first workshop, Nancy?
Probably not until 1995. I'd already been quilting for about 20 years.
Oh.
But,
that's incredible.
Yes. One of the things I wanted to mention today was that we have some lovely choices in applique-specific conferences now. Mm-hmm. Ellie Sienkiewicz's long-running conference ended last year, and a few more have sprung up to fill the breach. Mm-hmm. We have Kathy Dunnigan's Academy of Applique just finished there in Texas for this year, and then the third annual Applique Away on Galveston Bay starts on February 22nd.
Oh, wow.
And then in Williamsburg, Virginia, March 2nd through 8th is a brand new Academy of Applique. And not least, but last on the calendar, is Baltimore on the Prairie in Nebraska City, Nebraska, starting September 23rd. I'm going to be teaching at the Williamsburg and the Nebraska conferences. And I wanted to encourage people to try one of these if they have never done one. There's usually classes for all skill levels. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the best way to learn is immersion. When you're at one of these conferences, you're there for usual multiple days. There's anywhere from a 1 to 3 day long class you can choose from, any number of them. And with that type of format, you get to see, hear, read the instructions, and whatever mm-hmm. your learning style is, it's going to fit you.
You know,
then you
I think
get to
that's
practice.
Yeah, that's
and get
really
the feedback.
The big difference between going and taking one class for, like, you know, 6 hours or sometimes just 3 hours at a quilt show to mm-hmm. going to these retreats, academies. They have various names, but there you work with the same person.
Yes. And I think you really get a chance to fine-tune your techniques, learn mm-hmm. new ones, and then practice them, get the feedback from the instructor. It's amazing how many people have said to me that it was just so life-changing on their skill level. So I think that the longer, you know, immersion you can get will give you that experience.
Now, how do you – you've taught these a lot. I tend to teach the one-day workshops. That tends to be my format. But you teach uh-huh. these longer things. And I'd really love you to share, how can a person prepare to go to that so they get the most out of it?
Well, I think the best thing to do is read the supply list and bring what it says. Because if you're prepared when you arrive, then you don't feel like you're catching up later. When I'm preparing to teach one of these classes, I'll have your freezer paper templates. They'll be all printed for you. All you have to do is cut them out. You don't have to spend your time tracing. I use a clear transparency overlay for placement. That's all printed for you. No more tracing. Bring your fabrics, bring an open mind, and come ready to learn. It's really just come and sit down and start.
You know, another thing I'd like to recommend, Nancy, is that people go out and learn a bit about the person they're going to take a work this workshop with. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to know about Nancy Kearns, you can, you know, go out and see her work. And then, of course, if you took her class, you'd have more understanding. Like if you're going to do mine, you go look at my things. Do you find sometimes people come into these long classes and they haven't any clue really what your style is?
Yes. I've had someone come in and go, what? It's not machine.
Oh. Uh-oh.
But not very often.
Right. Yeah. I think nowadays with the internet, it's a lot easier than it was 20 right. years
and
ago when these academies were.
For the conferences, they all have websites that give you a teacher bio, you know, usually show a picture of their work. There's a picture of the project and then the class description and the supply list. So with all that, you should have a very clear understanding of what you're going to be doing in class.
Now, do people bring their own lights, their own chairs? I mean, because
I've had all of those. Yes,
yeah.
Lights are particularly important. Most conference centers do their best, but really don't have the quality of light that we need for applique. So most people bring an aught lamp. Most conferences are, you know, have the cords already down on the floor for you just to tap into with your lights or your little iron or whatever you want to bring. I've had people bring chairs, if you're, especially if they're, you know, of course, if they're driving.
Right.
But yes, whatever makes you the most comfortable. I like a little footrest. So if I'm driving, I might bring that to put under the table. So move in and be comfortable. One of the advantages of these long-term classes is then you have extra, this bonus time you can stitch during, they usually have a two-hour lunch break. You can go back in the room and sew. Mm-hmm. You can leave your things in the room for the multiple days. You can sew in the evening. You can really get a lot of experience in that length of time.
Yes. I just taught on a cruise, Nancy, and this particular organizer, which is with Stitch in Heaven, they gave each student their own space for the entire time, and the teachers moved between the rooms. So even though our class was one day, they got a feel for that sort of long-termness of it because they had their little nest. They called it, you come make your nest.
Oh, how nice.
So
This is nice that you don't have to constantly be setting up, packing up, setting up, packing up, because that just wastes a lot of time.
It does. It does. And let's talk a little bit about how a person can kind of think about what they want to get out of the class. Because, you know, you go and you see the conference site and you go, okay, I'm going to take this with Nancy Kearns and this is her project. But now take it a step further. If you are having the students come, what else would you want them to think about? Is there certain questions, certain like goals they might get out of the class that they can think about in advance?
Well, you know, what's really nice is if they have a particular problem area, if they can bring a sample from home that shows where they're having a struggle, then in between the demonstrations when I'm circulating around, I can work with them one-on-one on those specific areas. So you can get over, you know, in case that isn't covered specifically in the class, you can still get input on that. But it is nice for people to say, okay, well, I'm going to take that block because I really have trouble with points, and she's really good with points, so I'm going to learn my points. That's going to be my goal. So there's lots of ways to approach it. Some people, frankly, take a class just for the social aspect. They enjoy sitting and sewing with their friends, and they usually learn something, too.
Yeah.
So you can be as intense or relaxed as you choose as far as you know what you want out of the class. But I love the really intense students that are there because they really want to learn. And some of them become some of my good friends afterwards because I just want to keep encouraging them.
They've got those points down. They got the points.
Now, I really encourage people to try any of these conferences. Baltimore on the Prairie is the longest running of the current conferences. They're heading into their seventh year, and it's in a brand new place in Nebraska City in Nebraska, a gorgeous conference center where the Arbor Day Foundation is located. So it's a beautiful campus.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to that one this fall.
So also, you know, we have to like sleep and eat when we go to these things. So is that often part of the package, or is it just really depend on the organizer?
I missed what you said.
Oh, like if, you know, like when people have to find a place, you know, they have to have a room to sleep in, they have to have you know, eating, you know.
That can vary. Some places you book your own room. The Williamsburg one, you book your own room, but breakfast and lunch are included in the class.
Okay.
In Nebraska, the room and all the meals are included with the conference price. So it just depends on the individual conference. I like not having to worry about arranging those things. So.
Right.
So yeah. That's my preference, but it just depends. Some people like to book their own rooms because they want to have, like, you know, get a suite and have three or four of their friends all stay together. So, you know, there's different options for them, too. So,
and there are other there's other conferences like Asilomar and some things like that that have been longstanding that are formatted so they're not just – the ones we're talking about here are Nancy's expertise, which is the applique. But there's conferences that have art quilts and piecing.
Oh, yes, and piecing. And there's, like you said, Asilomar. There's
There's one up north.
Name. In Wisconsin or something.
Yeah.
It might come to me. I'm more familiar, obviously, with the applique because that's what I do. But there are other opportunities around the country for these multiple day classes, which are it's a dream vacation.
Yeah.
You get there and all you're responsible for doing is sewing and eating and sleeping. I love it.
That is the best part. Now, we have a minute. Do people normally have options to buy a kit or not?
That depends on the teacher.
Okay.
For applique, because there's usually a large number of different fabrics used.
Yeah.
And the choices are so individually specific to, you know, what you like. Some people like batik, and others don't.
Yeah.
I usually, if there's some very specific fabrics that really make the block, I will provide those in a small partial kit.
Okay.
But I don't.
Nancy, this has been so much fun. We're out of time.
Oh, all right.
I know. Thank you for coming back and talking about taking long-term workshops. This has been so interesting.
Well, thanks a lot for calling, Pat.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
Choose from more than 100 of your favorite patterns from American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilts and More, and Quilt Sampler, all available online. Buy downloadable patterns today at apqshop.com.
Challenges hitting the road. Come sew with the staff of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine at the Sewing and Stitchery Expo in Puyallup, Washington, February 26th through March 1st of 2015. Everything needed to make the pillowcases will be available for free. Pillowcases will be donated to the children being treated at Mary Bridge Children's Hospital. Stop by the Showplex and use your sewing skills to help a good cause. If you can't stay to make a pillowcase, no worries. Drop off your completed pillowcase to add to the total. See you there.
This is the TogiNet Radio Network, broadcasting quality programming to the world.
Here's a special offer just for radio listeners. Get 2 full years of American Patchwork and Quilting delivered right to your door for less than half the cost on the newsstand. You won't miss an issue that's packed with never-before-seen projects from top designers, complete materials lists for all projects, and easy-to-use pull-out patterns and quilting diagrams. Subscribe today online, and you'll also get a free downloadable pattern. Check it out. Go to allpeoplequilt.com.
Follow American Patchwork and Quilting on Pinterest to find ideas for bags, baby projects, pillowcases, storage and organization, and more. Visit Pinterest.com/APQ magazine to join the fun.
Welcome back to American Patchwork and Quilting's podcast. I'm your host, Pat Sloan. Sometimes when I'm at a show, I meet a quilter and we start chatting, and then It's just sort of this great conversation that I think you need to hear. So that's what happened when I was in Houston. And Robin Buscemi came up and she started telling me about, you know, we just started talking. She was telling me about her quilt in the Houston show and the stories and the challenges that she likes to do for herself. So I said, oh gosh, Robin, you really need to come on and tell me a bit about your work. So I invited her on, but we seem to have just lost her for a second. So while we call her back and get her back on the show here, Robin's website is called threadsbespoke.com, and she has a gallery of her work that she's exhibited and talks about the stories behind them. So Robin, how are you? Okay, we're going to get Robin on here in just a moment, rephoning her. One of the great things that Robin does is build a story before she starts working on the quilt. She has she's accepted a challenge and then she starts working on it. Hi, Robin. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, Pat. How are you today?
I am wonderful. It was so fun to stop and or have you stop and chat with me in Houston. And I am excited to hear about your quilt making. Tell me a little bit about your style.
I actually use a quilting style that I call pulling from my tapestry bag. So, of course, that's an imaginary tapestry bag. But
right.
What it is it incorporates everything that I've learned along my journey. So embroidery, paper piecing, applique, mini piecing, whatever it is that I have, I put it into this tapestry bag. Mm-hmm. And then when I'm creating a quilt, I pull from that bag to see which technique that I would like to use to accomplish whatever my design is.
I love that visual. You are so good at that, Robin.
Thank you.
Yeah, just being able to express, I mean, because I can imagine you looking in your bag. Do you actually keep, journals and things with ideas, or is it mostly in your head?
It's both, actually. I have a lot of things that I keep in my head, but then I also have photographs, and I have journals and folders that I collect things or something that I've tried, and I mm-hmm. keep it in this book so that I can find it again when I want to use it for some design.
Perfect. Let's talk about the quilt that you entered, because you love challenges. That's how we got started.
Yes.
And in Houston, there's always multiple challenges that are hung. And one of the ones that I shared a photo of was your red and white, which was a spectacular challenge. And your quilt is just gorgeous. How do you approach challenges?
That one was something that Houston called out. There was a call for entries for red and white quilts. They were looking for current quilts. And they spoke about the exhibit that hung in New York City about 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I had seen that exhibit, and I saw all those beautiful red and white quilts cascading down like waterfalls from the ceiling, and I thought mm-hmm. it was just spectacular. So I tried to create a quilt that would have the visual impact for Houston, and I had been to Houston before, mm-hmm. so I knew that I had to create something that would just wow people so that you could see it from far away. Mm-hmm. And because I was working on a Quilt Alliance, their annual contest, the Chicago Board of Trade, which is the other picture of the quilt that you had posted, mm-hmm. I just kind of went along with that. And since I'm from Chicago and have a lot of memories of that building, I yeah. decided that would show, you know, good lines for a quilt that would just be visible from far away.
It looks, your red and white, I like Art Deco and Craftsman. You know, I know those are two different styles, but that one could, to me, go sort of either way. Is that the feel that you were going for?
Yes, it is Art Deco. Mm-hmm. The Chicago Board of Trade was built in 1930. And it was just before the Chicago World's Fair, so I used a play on the building lines as well as the movement. When you mm-hmm. look at something Art Deco, you always see something movement, even though they're linear lines or curvy lines. They're displaced or something. Like if you mm-hmm. look at one of the squares on the outer edges, there's these curvy lines that lead to an arrow, but the curvy lines don't match up to the center. They are offset.
Right.
So that way, when you see those curvy lines, it makes you feel like the quilt is moving and your eyes will move around the quilt.
That is cool because it actually feels – it's almost like a big chunky plus sign, the one block. And so it feels like depth, like there's depth, like almost like the top of the building, which would be coming out. I mean, you could look at it so many ways.
Mm-hmm. The eight outer squares are actually representative of the trading pit because there's octagons for the trading pits.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made those to represent that since trading is now going, you know, online, so they don't do it on the floors anymore, really. And also for the windows, because I wanted to project how the tall windows and you can see into the building. And actually, people used to bring their crops to the north side where the big windows are to show their crops to see whether there would be trading futures on that particular, whoever the person was that was bringing their crop. So it's just sort of a representation of that era.
So, Robin, when you're doing something like this, for people who have never really sort of attempted a challenge, do you build yourself a story or does it sort of explode as you start working?
I actually started with a story. So I had been researching the Chicago Board of Trade for that other quilt.
Mm.
And because I had developed, you know, more information, that's how I tested out one of the squares. So each of the outer eight squares are actually four squares with the center cross added in just to for the windows.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did tests of it to see what it was going to look like. And those little red pieces are actually a quarter of an inch wide.
Oh, my
so they're
goodness.
Very narrow. And then the other logs are an inch wide. So I had to do a test of it first and lay out on the floor and on the divine wall.
Yeah. How do you keep all those quarter inch strips straight? I mean, you know how things just seem like fabric moves. Do you like starch the heck out of it?
You can't starch it. What I did to make it easy, since this had a very short lead time, was I actually cut each of those individually. So they're each cut and pieced individually.
Oh, wow. You are quite the person. That's like, oh my
God. Crazy, goodness. A little crazy.
A little crazy. So tell me just, you and I were chatting back and forth about techniques, and one of the things you do is use a roulette for needle turning. And I really don't know anything about that. Tell me about it.
When I went to the Tokyo Quilt Show, there were ladies, and they didn't speak English. They were using this little roulette wheel. And I saw it, and I thought, I don't know what they're doing. And then there's a store in New York, Pinwheels, and she's from the United States. Her husband's Japanese, and she had that roulette wheel. So she showed me in English what they were doing.
Mm.
So what you do, like on the back of your piece, you would trace along your fold line. So for needle turn, wherever your fold line is going to be, you could go along that because that little wheel is very small and it actually pre-creases the fabric. So it assists you when you're needle turning. Mm. And in the case of my red and white quilt, because you don't want to put any markings on white, I used that wheel and I rolled along to make my lines before I placed it under my sewing machine to quilt it.
So the roulette wheels, it's sort of like the thing that we used to use in dressmaking, clothing making.
It's similar to a tracing wheel, but it's much smaller.
Much smaller. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. So tell me what kind of a project are you working on right now?
I'm working on another piece from my Japan series, which is modeled after, in Kamakura, there's a street that had a beautiful pattern to it. And so I took a photograph so that I could use that for a quilt later. So I'm doing something similar to that. And currently my other piece is in New York with the Textile Study Group of New York at the Narthex Gallery in New York City, if you're up there.
If we're up there, well, heck, everybody should just run up there, I think. That would be good. So another thing that you have participated in is American Patchwork and Quilting's 1 million pillowcase challenge. Why did you feel, why did you do that? You know, what did it mean to you?
For me, it means giving back to the community. I like to make pillowcases for like Concur cancer patients.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Also for women with breast cancer, since my sister had breast cancer.
Wow.
And also for people that lose their homes due to fire, tornadoes, hurricanes, tsunamis. So I've been making pillowcases, and I thoroughly enjoy doing that for other people.
Well, we appreciate it, American Patchwork and Quilting. It's a big project, a million pillowcases. Everybody needs to go online and put in their numbers, because I know you're all making them. You're making them.
Yes.
So tell me what is on your website. We have like about a minute. Tell me what people can find there.
I have a gallery of pictures. I actually do some hand embroidery as well. So I have a globe that I actually made for someone, which the story behind that is Westcott School. When kids were in school, the girls would have to make their globe. The boys would get their globe, but the girls had to make theirs. So
wow.
I decided I would make my globe, and I actually made that as a gift for my friend, so it's related to her life.
Oh, it's very cool. People need to go check it out. And you write on your blog so that you share your process so people can see how these quilts that you're doing materialize. It's fascinating. You have some great step-outs there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And then you also do some mixed media, that's what the globe is, and some of the pieces like that.
Yeah, the globe is mixed media just because I did hand embroidery with silk, mm-hmm. and then I do other pieces that actually have things that stand out, like the piece that's hanging in New York. Mm-hmm. That actually has a gentleman hanging from a bucket on the side of a building.
Oh.
And it's called Hanging by a Thread.
Wonderful. Well, Robin, this has been so much fun. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after the break.
Boost your sewing skills from start to finish with daily tips from the editors of American Patchwork and Quilting. Visit tips.allpeoplequilt.com for inspiration. This quilting tip brought to you by Moda Fabrics. Visit modafabrics.com or your local quilt shop to see the latest fabric collections. Set yourself up to stitch a little every day. When you finish stitching, before putting everything away, rethread your needle and take the first stitch. Then the next time you pull out your project, you'll be ready to sit down and start stitching.
Hi, I'm Linda Augsburg. Join me in 2015 for a brand new video series called Show Me How, brought to you by Baby Lock. Each month, I'll show you how to complete a simple project from start to finish. Learn new techniques, see tips, and sew a great project. Visit allpeoplequilt.com/videos to watch.
Take an ultimate shop hop tour of 11 top quilt shops. You'll find them all in the current issue of Quilt Sampler, available now at your local quilt shop or on newsstands.
Welcome back to American Patchwork and Quilting's podcast. I'm your host, Pat Sloan. Now, for the second half of the show, I asked Elizabeth Daxson to come back on. She's been on here before, and we always have a fantastic time. But today, we're going to spend an extra bit talking about paper piecing and other things that are going on with Elizabeth. So thank you for coming back.
Thanks for having me again, Pat. It's always so good to talk to you.
I know. It is fun. It is great to be able to spend some time. So let's see. We're going to talk about paper piecing because you have an online workshop for this. And I want to, you know, really give people some sort of deeper understanding. When did you first take a paper piecing, you know, try it? Did you take a class? What did you do?
I wish I'd taken a class first. as with many other things in quilting, I just kind of dove in.
Yeah.
I'm always a kind of fly by the seat of my pants or type of person when it comes to learning new techniques in quilting, and mm-hmm. paper piecing was really no different. I was involved in a quilting bee with a lot of good friends, and we liked to challenge each other. So one month, one of our friends decided to do paper piecing. It was a circle of geese block, which was real popular at the time, and now being an experienced paper piecer, it's a very straightforward and simple block, but at the time, oh my goodness, that block got the best of me. This is about, gosh, I guess about almost 3 years ago now. And I just had the worst time of it. It was like driving on the wrong side of the road, but worse.
Yeah.
It just was so difficult to grasp. And without someone to walk me through it or some kind of, you know, really detailed instructions, I really, I kind of sunk instead of swam. I threw the block across the room many times. It was not pretty, very much so.
I find that so funny because now you are in love with this. I mean, I don't, do you do everything paper piece now? I mean, it's just...
I would say it's probably at least 80% of my piecing.
Yeah,
maybe
that's a lot.
Maybe more.
Yeah,
it is. It really is. It's if you had told me then when I was working on that block that that would be the thing I would fall in love with most in quilting, mm-hmm. I would have laughed in your face. I probably would have called you silly names too because I would never have believed that that was possible.
So how long? Okay, so when this happened, you're like, okay, been there, done that. Did you personally then take it on as a challenge to learn, or did it? Did you have to have a break from it?
I think that I'm very hard-headed when it comes to quilting things. I don't like to feel beaten by a technique. So I think mm-hmm. when I had that really terrible first experience, I thought, okay, this is not rocket science. There's mm-hmm. got to be a way for me to understand this. And so I did kind of take it on as a personal challenge to really wrap my head around it and get the hang of it because I saw so many beautiful blocks being done at the time on Flickr and lots of quilting bees that were just beautifully precise and mm-hmm. through foundation paper piecing. And I thought, well, I really want to be able to do that. So I kind of had to set my head straight. I had to set aside that frustrating experience mm-hmm. and try to walk to it fresh and try again. I think a lot of times as quilters, when we come across a new technique and we try it and it's a bad experience the first time, it can make it really hard to try and come back the second time fresh and to give it a fresh try.
Yeah, I can totally relate to this. I did exactly what you're saying with machine quilting because I had a crappy beginner machine, which never would free motion nice. But I was like, I am going to learn to free motion. I don't care how many machines and feet I have to go through. And it's just, you get that sort of competitive spirit to,
Yes, that's exactly the word. Yes.
You gotta beat it. I'm going to learn this thing. Dang it. Let's first talk about your experience in making it click with you. Did you end up deciding to take a workshop or did you just purchase a book that clicked with your brain and helped you? What did you do?
Ultimately, in trying to tackle that first block, I think it was a four template block ultimately divided into four quarters. Mm-hmm. So I had to get through that block, those quarters four times successfully. And the first one probably took about 10 or 11 tries before I started to actually put the pieces in the right place and mm-hmm. sew things together correctly. So by the time I got through that block, it started to click. It started to sort of make sense because I'd gone through about 16 templates at that point just in trying to get through that one block. So after that, I did a lot of reading. I tend to read for the most part when it comes to learning for me, in part mm-hmm. because I can do it at my leisure. Mm-hmm. whenever I want to, but also because that was what was convenient for me at the time. I didn't really have access to workshops and mm-hmm. couldn't really find much online in terms of video classes or anything like that. So I did a lot of reading on blogs, asked questions of people, mm-hmm. which was something that I think I had not thought to do previously. Instead of just sitting by myself in a room trying to figure things out, I asked questions. I left comments on blogs. Hey, what does this mean? Or how did mm-hmm. you do that? Mm-hmm. And I learned that way. And by doing a lot, that really helped a lot. I tried to find some more basic patterns to tackle mm-hmm. and built my confidence that way. I decided that maybe, you know, going to a simple block, like an economy block, mm-hmm. trying about five pieces of fabric was a really good way to try to build up that confidence.
So I really like that. I like the fact that you took it on as a job. You're like, you know, this is, I need to figure it out. And what are the different methods? So you became very proficient at it. And what I want to do now is let's sort of switch it over and talk about how people can become successful at this. Because really, I am not a huge paper piecer myself, but I do love what it can do for me. I mean, I could never do a Mariner's Compass that I've done without it. It's
absolutely.
Just, you know, I've done one by hand piecing a Mariner's Compass, which is fine, but I don't, mm-hmm. I want to go a little faster than that.
Oh, I understand.
They're very slow, by hand. So,
yeah.
somebody who's kind of maybe had a little stab at it like you did originally and went like, this, you know, there's something in my, that's not working for my brain. What are kind of the top things, couple of things, how people can approach learning?
I think that one of the things that's really important to have a successful experience with paper piecing is to cut your fabric in such a way that it's oversized for the area you're covering on the paper template. There's a couple reasons for this. Number one, for your ease, so that you don't have to tear off and trust me, unpicking paper piecing stitches can really, really be painful and, and very difficult because you're using that shorter stitch length. But oversized cutting makes it so much easier to line up the fabric. You don't have, if you're off by, you know, a quarter of an inch, you've got an extra quarter of an inch or more built into that fabric that you've cut, so you don't have to take out those tiny, tiny stitches. I think that a lot of people think then that that wastes a lot of fabric, but ultimately, in the grand scheme of things, if it helps save your sanity, I say waste a little bit of fabric. Nothing wrong with that. I think that's one of the biggest things to make paper piecing easier, because that was the thing I think I had so much trouble with early on. That and understanding where the fabric goes. You see this template and it has these lines and it has these letters and numbers, and you think that's where my fabric needs to go. I'm not sure what it is that makes us think that's where the fabric should go, but it should not. It should always be on the unprinted side of the paper. Once you can start to get the hang of that, I think it all starts to come in and click together in such a way that makes sense. The last thing that's super important, I think, is to check your work. Never, never, never trim any of your fabric until you've checked to make sure that the fabric you've just sewn in place covers where you want it to cover and all that good stuff. That way you still can hit that undo button with your seam ripper if you have to. You've not done anything that can't be undone.
I like the undo button for the seam ripper. This, like, I need your seam ripper, Elizabeth. What seam ripper do you have?
That's the one notion that I think the quilting industry is lacking. Someone needs to come up with that.
Right. Just hand it over and it just, you know, run it through there, like, you know, like a little conveyor belt. Put it in and it comes undone on the other end. Wouldn't that be cool? Okay, we'll start working on
that.
One of the things that I think with paper piecing is that I always tell people it's upside down and backwards, and you're trying to you know, tap your head and pat your stomach, all of this at the same time, because we just don't normally work upside down and backwards. And that is hard. It's hard for a lot of people. Also, the frugality part. Quilters generally are very frugal. And so, you know, they always try to use that little wispy piece to fill in. You know, it'll fit.
I can relate. I've been there.
I think we all have. We're like, and then you flip it over and it doesn't go all the way out. Let's talk about paper. Let's talk about paper first. What, you know, people who are just trying this are going to probably use the paper they run through their printer. But there are better options, right?
Well, it depends. Better is kind of subjective. Personally, I use printer paper. It's easy for me to pick up at Target. If they don't have it at Target, typically it's not at my house. That's kind of my rule of thumb with most things, especially because I paper piece so much. For me, it just makes sense. Paper, when you buy it at Target, typically you're buying, you know, cheap recycled paper. Typically, it has a decent amount of sheerness to it, so you can see through it enough to see your placements of your fabric and such. And if you have a difficult time with that, you can always hold up your paper template to a light source, whether it's, you know, a fancy schmancy Ott light or just your regular old desk lamp. A little bit of light behind it will do wonders, even if it is a pretty thick piece of paper. There are special papers made for foundation piecing. The advantages that those papers have is that they're a bit sheerer, and they tend to perforate a little bit more easily so that the paper can be removed a little bit more readily. That's not to say that printer paper cannot be removed from a paper pieced block easily. I think if you score your paper using a fingernail or a seam roller, I think printer paper perforates quite nicely and tears fairly easily. But a lot of people who don't paper piece super often and want the process to be as easy as possible like to use that foundation paper for their paper templates, because it can be printed through a printer so that you can ensure that there's good consistency amongst your templates, you know, that they're all the same size and all that fun stuff. But the paper then is a little bit easier to work with its sheerness and readiness for perforation.
Yeah, I tend to be like you. I'm at home. I want to do this. It's whatever paper's in my machine. You know, that's in my printer. You know, that's what I'm going to use. Let's we have time here before the break, so we get a couple more things in about this. Let's talk about the stitch length, because you already mentioned that you're going to shorten it some. But what exactly do you tell people? I mean, how much shorter?
I typically, for paper piecing, will set my machine to a 1.5 millimeter stitch. That tends to be the sweet spot for my machine. That being said, I've met a couple of machines in teaching that have been just a teensy bit too generous on a 1.5 millimeter stitch that I've bumped down even as low as a 1.2 millimeter. The key is that you want to be perforating the paper, but not so much that the paper is actually starting to come apart as you're sewing. If you're at that point, you need to bump it up just a little bit to just a little bit of a larger stitch. But ideally, what you want to be able to do is to perforate the paper the same way that you've got a checkbook, for example, how you can just rip that gently and easily and have your checks come right out. That's what we're trying to create with that shorter stitch length.
And then you also talked about either scoring it or folding it. What's the what does that mean? Tell me.
What that means is folding the paper back along that seam line and then running something over it that then just perforates it that much easier. I tend to use a fingernail. Not everybody has fingernails that work well for scoring. If you keep your nails really short or if you bite your nails, that won't work so well for you. You can utilize a seam roller for that. You can even utilize the edge of a notebook or some kind of surface that has just a little bit of something to it, whether it's your seam ripper, the long edge of your seam ripper, not the pointy side, the long edge.
Right.
You can use the handles of your scissors. Really just something that's nice and flat works really well for that.
And that would be doing it on a flat surface too, like not on your ironing board.
Yes, of course.
Yep.
No, not on your ironing board, but definitely nowhere near the iron. You don't want to burn yourself by accident. And you do want a nice flat surface underneath you. So a desk is good.
Tabletop, that kind of thing. Yeah, like if you're at your sewing machine, most of us have a little space to one side that we could do that. And then if that we have like about 10 seconds here. But if we have a piece that is getting sort of stuck in there, do you use tweezers to get it out on a narrow area?
Yes, definitely. Tweezers can be super helpful for that.
Okay. Well, fabulous. Well, Elizabeth, you're going to come back after the break. I'm so excited. And we're going to talk about this just a little bit more, and then we're going to talk about storage, okay?
Sounds good.
We'll be right back.
Looking for fresh, simple, and fun projects and ideas? Check out the current issue of Quilts & More magazine at your local quilt shop or on newsstands.
This quilting tip brought to you by Moda Fabrics. Visit modafabrics.com or your local quilt shop to see the latest fabric collections. To maintain consistency when piecing, keep your eye on the spot where the needle enters the fabric, not the needle going up and down.
Hi, I'm Linda Augsburg, executive editor of American Patchwork and Quilting, and I'd like to invite you to join me in making pillowcases and creating smiles. For people who love to sew or quilt, it's so easy to lift spirits and bring smiles to hospitalized kids, homeless families, and others in need. Simply join American Patchwork and Quilting Magazine's 1 Million Pillowcase Challenge. Make one, two, or more pillowcases and donate them in your local community. You'll create just as many smiles. Join the movement today. Find complete details, download free patterns, and record your donations online at allpeoplequilt.com/million pillow.
See what other quilters are up to on the American Patchwork and Quilting page on Facebook. Simply go to facebook.com and search for APQ Magazine.
Welcome back to American Patchwork and Quilting's podcast. I'm your host, Pat Sloan, and I am talking to Elizabeth Daxson of Don't Call Me Betsy about foundation paper piecing. Elizabeth, one of the other things I wanted to know about how you work and how it works for you is, when do you press the fabric? I mean, what is your process there?
Oh, that's a super question. I tend to be a little bit lazy when it comes to pressing. Now, the best rule of thumb to follow is to press with every single piece of fabric that you add to your template. That is the absolute best way to do it. But if you're a little bit lazy like I am, you can cheat by finger pressing your fabric at your sewing table, making sure to keep your template on a nice flat surface. And again, if you're not much of a fingernail keeper, that's okay. You can use one of those flat surfaces like the handle of your scissors or the handle of your seam ripper to do that for you as well, or a seam roller. But really, it's important to make sure to do that at every single addition. So if you don't get up to iron at every addition, make sure at least to finger press at each single addition that you do.
And the reason why is that it'll, if you don't have it flat, it's going to poof up, and then your block is not going to be flat.
Yeah, right.
So it needs to be. Now, the other thing, too, I'm sure that you've run into this a little bit, is that people need to test their ink out of their machine to be sure that they can heat it. There are wax printers. I personally use a wax printer. It's like crayons. You can't you can't iron on my paper. I have to use the inkjet to do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, it's not nice to get all that crap all over everything. It makes a bit of a mess. Too much of a mess.
Yes, no fun.
No fun. So what is the biggest hurdle? I mean, you've taught this a lot. You have your class online, which we'll talk about in 1 second. So you've introduced this to a lot of students very quickly in the past year or so. What is the biggest thing they need to overcome? What's the biggest hurdle?
I think the biggest hurdle is understanding where the fabric goes and what direction the fabric goes, where exactly it goes on the template. So understanding first that it needs to go on that unprinted side of the paper, and then understanding that it's not as intuitive as we'd like paper piecing to be. Logic tells us that if I need to cover up section A2 on my template, that's where I'm going to line up my fabric. Mm-hmm. But if you do that, ultimately, it's not going to land in the A2 section once you've sewn it in place. We always need to make sure to line up your fabric where you've just been, not where you actually want the fabric to end up in the finished block. That's the rule that I like to try to teach with, because our instinct just tells us, it just wants us to cover up that A2 area. But if that's where we put the fabric and we sew a seam, we're going to have a nasty seam sticking out, and it's not going to cover the area we wanted to cover. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges in paper piecing, is getting that ingrained in your brain as you're paper piecing.
So tell me what people learn in your Craftsy class.
In the Craftsy class, we walk through paper piecing step by step. Not only are we giving out the templates and then the cutting instructions to go with each block, but I physically walk through each block showing exactly where I'm holding my fabric to place it just so, talking about any challenges with each of the blocks as we're going through them, if there's any tricky areas where we need to pay close attention to lining up the fabric. Some kinds of angles, for example, are a little bit more challenging to line up the fabric, so we talk a good bit about that. We talk about the tools that you must have and the tools that you can get away with skipping over, like we talked about with the paper earlier. And a lot of it is just seeing me go through the motions and starting to not only understand the process, but also seeing the process to help that really sink in.
Very good. And they can find a link. I put one on my blog for the radio show page today, but Elizabeth has them at her website, and you could just search her name when you go over there. I mean, I've watched it. It's great. It's a wonderful class. You did a great job.
Thank you.
Yeah. So let's switch gears a little bit, because American Patchwork and Quilting Magazine, Family of Magazines, has a focus for storage and organization here at the beginning of the year. And what do you know? I was looking at your blog, and there is your fabric. It's like perfect.
Thanks.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know. It's like, it looks like a store. Does your fabric always look this perfect?
well, For example, right now I have a stack of fabric on my cutting table that needs to be bolted and put onto shelves, but generally I do try to keep it really tidy because if I can't find the fabric, I can't use the fabric.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to be pretty tidy with my fabric storage because if I can't find it, it's hard to cut into it and actually make use of it.
Yeah. So are you wrapping them on a board? That's what it looks like.
I am.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they're vertical.
I use comic book backing boards.
Okay.
They're fairly inexpensive. And I can buy lots of them on Amazon, which is super handy. And I wrap each piece of fabric on one of those boards, and I secure it either with a paper clip or with a nice, really, really fine-tipped pin.
Okay.
I like to sort the fabric by color so that it's just really that pretty, and I love rainbow,
it
so
is.
It makes me extra happy. And then I keep my solids in a separate area, also in rainbow order, so it's the prints area and then the solids.
Okay, so you don't mix them up. So you,
I don't.
Yeah. Okay, so now this is the million-dollar question, because if you saw my fabric, you would just, you know, probably have a heart attack because I can't fold fabric neatly to save my life. It's my, you know, I have them. I really can't. It just doesn't work. So when you need to work with a piece of fabric, so I'm assuming, you know, you get it out on your table and you work with it, you're going to end up with, you know, stuff that doesn't roll back on there tidy. What do you do with it?
Then it gets downgraded to Scraplandia.
Oh.
If it doesn't fit back on the comic book backing board, I have a bin for each color of the rainbow, and then I have two for blue because I apparently have a serious affinity for blue. And if it's something that doesn't fit, even if it's a fat quarter, because fat quarters don't fit on my comic book backing boards the way I fold my fabric, it gets downgraded into one of those bins. I try and fold nicely, but I'm not always super at it, so sometimes it's in piles in those bins, and those are, I think, they can't be gallon bins. They might be, though. They're kind of large.
And where do you hide those? Because I don't see them in that picture.
Yes, they live in my closet in my sewing area. I have one of those cube organizers that you can get at IKEA. I think it's called a Calyx. And I keep the cubes in the closet, nice and tidy, and I keep one bin in each cube.
Yeah. So you sound a bit like me, where you like to have your workspace, your studio space, kind of not chaotic looking, but kind of soothing looking. Is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very true. I know lots of creative people have to have a mess to be creative, but for me, it makes the OCD side of me just really freak out. So I really do need things to be kind of tidy. I do make a mess, but then I have to clean it up before I start something new.
Yeah, that's the way I am. Besides like the fabric that I can't fold neatly because I'm genetically not able to, I have them in bins that I don't see, you know, how they kind of look. They're just the tops peek out. So the bins are all the same color. So that when you sit in your space for so long, we work, because it's our business, I think we do work a little bit differently than somebody where it's their hobby and they have, you know, they work somewhere else and they come home and they love all the chaos. I'm like, oh my gosh.
It makes my skin crawl.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, fold it back up. Okay. So now pretty soon here, the Modern Quilt Guild is holding their second quilt show called Quilt Con in Texas. And you, you have a job with the Modern Quilt Guild. What are you doing with them now?
I sure do. I am the events manager for the Modern Quilt Guild, so I work full-time on putting together events like QuiltCon. So that is my shindig.
So that's your guild. Your guild officership is for the big umbrella rather than a local chapter.
Yes. I work directly for the National Guild.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So the people who aren't really familiar with that, it's one of the few, there's, I think, some art guilds that are formatted the same way, where there's like an upper level guild and then there's individual chapters. But if you don't have a chapter near you, you can join the main guild so that you can get the newsletter and get all the info. And they have a show once a year. When you go to the show, what, or any quilt show, Elizabeth, what attracts you? I mean, what do you beeline for the quilts, for your friends, what?
Oh, that's a tough call. I know I do definitely beeline for my friends because I don't get to see them anywhere near as often as I like. But when it comes to thinking about the show itself, I think I tend to look for the most colorful, vibrant kind of quilt. That's what pulls me in first, for sure. I do really love quilts that are monochromatic and two color, but the one that's the most vibrant, the loudest, that's usually the one that's going to call to me first.
And are you looking at, I mean, do you have a curiosity about the techniques that are used, or is it more like the visual impact?
For me, usually it's more about visual impact, but depending on how attracted I am to the actual piecing, then I definitely start to get curious about, well, wait, how'd they make that? And I go and read the sign and that type of thing.
Yeah, I think I'm a bit like that too. I mean, I'm a visual, and sometimes I might not even care how it was made. You know, it's like, I just love the impact it makes, the wow factor. I mean, if it's like calling to me from across the show, I'm like excited. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, let's go look at that one first. So I wanted to ask you about your, the new addition to your family that I have seen on Instagram. This white fluffy being that's in your house now. So you have a new puppy.
Yes. I do. He is.
Is he helpful?
Gosh, he seems so big now. He's not quite so puppyish, but he is only going on 7 months old here. He is a golden doodle, and he is kind of like a giant Muppet. I've heard people that he looks like the dog or dragon dog, whatever he is, from the Neverending Story movies. I've heard that he looks like a Muppet. He's just like a little furry person. He's so got so much personality. I think he's very curious about all this sewing nonsense. He loves quilts very, very much. He likes to lay on them. He'd really like to chew on them, but he knows he's not supposed to do that. He, for the most part, he'll like to curl up at my feet when I'm sewing. But when he starts to get tired of just curling up at my feet and wants my attention, he'll start to jump on my back or on my arm. And he's actually managed to get his paws on the sewing machine a few times. He's not actually done any sewing, but I do see that probably happening inadvertently in his future.
Yeah, mine used to sleep on, like, roll over onto the presser foot. I mean, the foot pedal. He'd roll over onto the foot pedal and be like, really? You know, my foot goes down, the machine starts running. It's like, oh, well, I just have a lot of fun. I don't have dogs right now because I travel too much, but I enjoyed seeing your, what's his name?
Maximus,
that's right. So tell me real quickly, just wrap up, what's going on at your website? What can people find there?
Sadly, at the moment, my website's a little bit left alone. I haven't had a lot of time to take care of it as of late, but you'll find tutorials, you'll find my pattern shop, you'll find links to my Craftsy class on paper piecing as well as my Craftsy class on free motion quilting on your domestic sewing machine, and lots of eye candy, definitely lots of pretty pictures.
Oh, super. Elizabeth, this has been wonderful.
Thank you. I'm so glad I got to come back on. It's so fun to chat.
Oh, good. Well, I will see you soon.
Sounds good.
This is American Patchwork and Quilting's podcast. I'm your host, Pat Sloan, and I would like you to go out and join our newsletters at allpeoplequilt.com on their website and on my website at patsloan.com. You can sign up for my newsletter. Join us online at Facebook. Follow us at Instagram, our Pinterest boards. There's always something new and exciting going on at American Patchwork and Quilting, and we'll see you next week.
Remember to visit allpeoplequilt.com for more information on topics from today's show, as well as how-to videos, free printable patterns, and additional tips and techniques. Thanks for listening.